one of the Mainbridge staff. Great to have you with us for Digital Church. And we're now actually also meeting again in person. So if you'd like to join us on a Sunday morning, we're doing it through a booking system, accessed through Church Suite. Or if you're a guest or you're checking us out, then get in touch via maybridge.org.uk and we'd be happily up for helping you to get booked in. We're spending each week at the moment looking at Matthew's Gospel. And right now we're in the middle of a bit called the Sermon on the Mount. It's a big chunk of Jesus' teaching, which is both world-changing and life-changing. And today we're looking at three little nuggets of wisdom, but look out for the unifying idea, which is it's all about the importance of commitment. That very fashionable word, commitment. And it starts with what Jesus says in Matthew 5 from verse 27. You've heard that it was said, "You shall not commit adultery." But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Now that sounds very extreme, doesn't it? The way Jesus speaks here assumes that anyone listening is married. And that's because at the time virtually everybody was. That's not true now, but at that time pretty much everybody was. That's why he talks in terms of avoiding adultery. And Jesus' audience would mostly have been peasant men, which is why I think he particularly addresses men. But this doesn't only apply to men. The thing Jesus condemns is looking at another person lustfully. What does he mean? What is lust? Lust is getting what you can from someone. It's enjoying them in some way, but their appearance and so on, and then imagining intimacy with them without actually being committed to them in real life. And it's bad because it turns a person into an object to be enjoyed rather than a person to be loved. And Jesus, as always, though, is less about the outward behaviour and more about the heart. I think lots of people would say, well, you know, I haven't had any affairs, so, you know, I'm doing fine. I'm a good wife or husband. But Jesus says, if in your heart you've done this, then that's a problem too. And when our culture thinks about this sort of thing, we think about sexuality in terms of freedom, and it's all about getting as much as you can. You know, sleep with whoever you want, look at pornography, which is apparently 30% of all the data transferred on the internet. Don't commit to anyone too much. And it sounds like a sort of freedom to have that perspective, but actually it's a sort of slavery to your own desires. Jesus knows that human freedom, enjoying relationships, is found in properly committing to a person. It's not by cheaply enjoying lots of different people, either physically or in your head. But Jesus doesn't just point out the depth of the problem. He's got practical advice. And he does this in a way that's memorable because he uses hyperbole. He uses an extreme way of putting it to make the point. At least I hope he isn't speaking literally when he says, if your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. If your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. Very strong imagery. And, you know, I haven't met anyone that's actually cut off body parts, but Jesus uses these strong images to make us feel how powerful a hold our sin has on us, and therefore how much effort we might need to make to get away from it, because it's deadly. So don't cut off body parts, but do get your body away from things that become tools that will help you to sin more. Just help yourself. If you struggle with drinking too much, don't go to the pub, or at least go with people who'll stop you. If you struggle with looking at the opposite sex in the wrong way, don't put yourself in a situation where you'll have the opportunity to do something you'll regret. If you struggle with lust really consistently, put some software on your computer that tells somebody else what you've done with it. Just help yourself. Our culture is all about doing what you want without restriction. But Jesus loves people enough and understands what we're like enough to say, for your own good, for your own health, for your own future, cut away the things in your life that cause you to sin, especially things around sex, because they tend to be so tempting that many of us would find it very hard to say no until it's too late. Yes, God forgives, and yes, self-discipline is a great thing, but help yourself and cut away the things in your life that make you prone to doing the wrong thing. Get practical, make it easier. The underlying idea here is that in all things, people make commitments, whether they're aware of it or not, through what they think about, what they love, what they lust after. And it's a serious thing. What you commit yourself to shapes your whole life. And that's certainly true in terms of sexual stuff. But as we'll see, it's not only about that. The second nugget here is about divorce, and Jesus says this. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you, anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now, as we look at this, I'm aware that at Maybridge there are a number of divorced people, people who've gone through divorce for all sorts of reasons, and many of those people have remarried. And if that's you, you might be a bit concerned when you read a text like this and have some questions. And I'd be happy to chat further if you find that helpful, so do get in touch if you would appreciate that. But it's worth knowing, at the time that Jesus spoke, men generally had a lot more social power, and they were the ones that could arrange a divorce if they wanted to. And in this little section, Jesus is making sure that they are not let off the hook. You see, the Old Testament permitted divorce in certain situations, but the reason that a certificate was required is probably so that someone couldn't just get a divorce on a whim, just, you know, spur of the moment. And what would happen is by the time you'd got all the paperwork, maybe people would have calmed down after an argument and there'd be some reconciliation or something. I think that was the hope. But people, men especially, were abusing the system and getting a divorce for silly reasons. It said that the religious teachers would allow a man to divorce his wife because she'd burned his breakfast. Terrible. But why would a man take advantage of this loophole? Well, at the time, the only reason that people would get a divorce was so that they could marry somebody else. That was sort of assumed when you got one. And so plenty of men were getting a divorce for the silliest of reasons, just so that they could marry another woman. And Jesus comes down on this like a ton of bricks. He says, if a man divorces his wife except for sexual immorality, then that man has made his wife the victim of adultery. In other words, he's been unfaithful to her. It's his fault. And so Jesus is saying, men, if your wife has gone off with someone else, okay, yeah, you've got grounds for a divorce in that situation. You don't have to get one, but certainly you've got a cause. Outside of that, you can't just get a divorce because you feel like it. And he also addresses the man who marries a divorced woman. And in this context, I don't think he means just any divorced woman. I think he means situations where men are getting a divorce and then getting a woman to get a divorce from her first husband so that he can then marry her, which legally would have been completely fine, totally by the book. But Jesus is saying, no, make no mistake, that's adultery too. You can't do that. You might be able to get the paperwork boxed off, but don't think that God is pleased about that behaviour. We've also got to say, the word here that is translated as adultery might be better translated as unfaithfulness. And that has a wider meaning. What this does is remind us, a marriage is broken not only when a person goes and sleeps with somebody else, but it can also be through things like neglect or abuse. And in this passage, Jesus is in particular talking about that problem of men getting a cheap divorce so they can marry somebody else. But that's, of course, not the only thing that ruins a marriage. We'll bump into that later in this series on Matthew's Gospel. But what does this passage have to do with us? Our laws and culture are not the same. At the time, Jesus was protecting women in particular in a culture where men had all the power over marriage and divorce. Women couldn't request a divorce unless they were very well off by their own means. And of course, there are places in the world that are still like this today. But in our culture, you can get a divorce if you want to. In theory, unless there's certain things going on, it's relatively easy to get a divorce. And yet still, men tend to have more power, even if it's not legal power. They often have more social power that's difficult to quantify. And yet this passage speaks not only to men, it speaks to women as well. If you think about the principles behind it, and again, how they point to how Jesus understands what commitment is supposed to be. Firstly, what Jesus teaches about the priority of marriage and the seriousness of divorce means we should think very carefully before committing to anyone in marriage. Now that may be obvious, but it seems to me that pretty much everyone is vulnerable to making potentially terrible decisions around marriage because we all get wrapped up in the excitement of it, the romance. We don't think straight when we feel in love. And so I'm a huge believer, if you're thinking of getting married, seek the thoughts and advice of people around you, people who know you well, people who know the other person well. We need to talk through our opinions and our expectations with anyone we would consider marrying so we can know as much as possible about exactly what we're getting ourselves into. Secondly, the idea behind what Jesus teaches means we should go into marriage planning for it to be permanent, planning for a lifelong commitment to another person. There's a comedy film called The Invention of Lying, which is set in a society where nobody has learned how to lie. And in one season, in one scene, there's a wedding, and the couple promise to stay together for as long as it's enjoyable and convenient to do so. And that's because, of course, they are telling the truth. That is the truth of their commitment. And that's funny, but it captures how a lot of people approach marriage, though, of course, they'd never say it that way. When I married my wife, Naomi, we both knew each other pretty well. We knew each other's views on lots of different things. And so we knew as far as we could know what we were committing to. But of course, things change. As the years go by, you change. You know, if kids come along as well, it's a whole other world. And so we committed to one another, knowing that we would change and our situation would change. And now we've been married 11 years and we're already quite different. But when you get married, the idea isn't that you can't commit just to the person who stood in front of you on the day when they look their best, but to the unknown person they will be in 30 years' time. That's what it's supposed to be. That's what the genuine commitment actually is. This year, with the increase in people being at home and with people being with their spouse a lot more, for many marriages, that'll be a great thing. And for others, it will bring up issues that were simmering under the surface. And sadly, I would imagine the rate of divorce is likely to go up. As we've come across a passage about marriage and divorce, this may be a good time for you to think about your marriage, if you are indeed married, and reflect if there are things that you could do to strengthen it right now. How has the pandemic affected you? Are you getting more time together or less time? Are money troubles or worries having a particular effect on you as a couple? When marriage works well, it's a wonderful thing, but it needs investing in. The third little jewel in this section, third little nugget, that's about commitment, is when Jesus talks about making oaths. Again, you've heard it that it was said to the people long ago, "Do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it's God's throne, or by earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. All you need to do is say simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one." Again, some strong language. Now, I don't know about you, I'm not really someone who makes oaths. It sounds like something from medieval times. You might hear people say things like, "I swear on my mother's grave," but personally, that's not something I say. That may be the case for you. But this is still very important, and here's why. Back in Old Testament times, swearing oaths was quite common. In fact, God sometimes was shown to be making oaths. It was a way of saying, "I'm telling the truth, and I know God will hold me accountable, so that will keep me honest." And the thing is, by the time of Jesus, the religious leaders had done what religious leaders often do, and they tried to find loopholes that meant that they could sort of do the right thing and yet still get away with doing what suited them as well. And they were really into Exodus verse 27 in the Old Testament, which says this, "You shall not take the name of the Lord in vain." Now in Hebrew, their language, God's name is Yahweh. And so they would make sure that they would never say God's name. They'd never say Yahweh. They still don't. They would never write it down even, just so that they could make sure that they would not take God's name in vain. If you don't say it, you can't take his name in vain. That was the logic. Now, on one level, that sounds very honourable. But what they would do instead is make promises by swearing on all sorts of other things. They'd swear on heaven or swear on earth or swear on the city of Jerusalem. And when they did this, they felt far more freedom to make promises that they couldn't keep. It didn't feel as serious to break a promise you'd sworn on Jerusalem than to one you'd sworn on God himself. And what Jesus does is call this out and say, hold on, that's a cheat. Anything you swear on is something that God made anyway, which should remind you, you can't get away from him. It's his throne, it's his footstool, it's the city that symbolises his presence. Any sort of lying or promise breaking or violation of an oath is against God, and he knows all about it, whether you've used his name specifically or not. And so when Jesus talks about oaths here, it's more specific than just lying or telling the truth. It's about what you commit to and whether you honour that commitment or you try and slide out of it. And here are some example oaths. We don't call them oaths, but they are, that I think we all hear or say all the time. And we use different language, but we make promises. The cheque is in the post. I'll definitely eat my vegetables if you give me a treat first. That was my daughter saying that one last night. I'll get back to you by tomorrow. I'll pray for you. Honestly, I'm a church leader and I've said that not and not done it a number of times. I apologise, but I have. They're all very simple little things. In our context, breaking oaths or breaking promises of commitment is so easy that we almost don't notice when it happens. I can't tell you how many times I've left my house and gone to a coffee shop to meet someone and then got a text at the exact time we were supposed to meet saying they can't make it. Mobile phones make it easy to back out of a commitment at the last second without having to look somebody in the eye. But even aside from technology, we are a culture that is very slow to commit to things. We like to sit on the fence, don't we, till the last minute. And another variation of this is when people say, when do I need to let you know by? When do I need to let you know by? Now, sometimes, of course, there are good reasons why we need to hold off on committing to something. But if you hear that sentence a lot, you'll know how it makes you feel. It feels disinterested. It feels dishonouring. What it often communicates is, I'm just waiting to see if a better offer comes up. And if it doesn't, I'll get on board with what you're asking me about. That is not the path to great relationships. And I think the root of it is, maybe we fear missing out on something or we fear being locked in and trapped. But the result is, it does harm in how we relate to other people. And it's into that sort of thing that Jesus says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Just be honest. Make clear commitments and honour them, even if you don't feel like it. In the long run, this will be great for your relationships. Our culture has a big emphasis on playing it cool and being non-committal, but the reality is, if you're non-committal to people and things, people will end up being non-committal to you. It won't be planned, but it will pan out that way. God's people don't need oaths. Just live honestly. Let your yes be yes and your no be no, and you will have an integrity that enriches all of your relationships. And so today we've looked at three classic nuggets on Jesus' teaching, all very practical for how we do relationships. And the theme that connects them all is commitment. They're all about how we do commitment well in real life. And commitment, it's one of those things that everyone likes in theory. We like the idea of a partner who is committed to us, or a friend who is committed to us, even an employer who's committed to us. We love the idea of commitment because it makes us feel valued and safe and wanted. And when we have commitment from somebody, it feels great. And not only that, but if you've ever been committed to someone else who is committed to you, you know there's joy and there's meaning from that relationship. It's a brilliant thing. The thing is, we tend to want all the privileges of committed relationships, and yet we struggle with the hard work of doing the everyday self-denial that real commitment means. We love our spouse, and yet we look at others lustfully. We love the idea of marriage, and yet we want the emergency escape option of divorce. We love our friends and family, and yet we don't follow through on all our commitments. We love people around us, and yet we fiercely want to avoid any feeling that we might be trapped. We love our church community, and yet we commit as far as it feels good to do so. Committing to someone or something properly over the long term is often really hard. But if you thought about what you commit to carefully, it's always more rewarding. And the great news that underpins all of this for followers of Jesus is he is the absolute model of commitment. He can say all this stuff because he also did it. Jesus was committed to us before we did anything at all. While God looked on us and just saw sinners, people committed to themselves, Jesus went to the cross to get us. He doesn't waver. He doesn't look at someone else and prefer them. He doesn't divorce himself from us. He doesn't say, oh, I'll think about it and let you know on Thursday. He doesn't say, I'll see what your church attendance is like and then I'll make up my mind about you. No, no. He is just 100% committed to us. It's why he died for us. It's why he promises to be with us by Spirit, his Spirit now. It's how we know everything he says about how to live life is good. And so as I finish, let me ask you to think a bit about commitment today and maybe discuss this with somebody else. Where are you sitting on the fence around commitment? Where are you keeping a distance, playing it cool, staying on the edges? And is there anyone you need to say sorry to because you've not been committed as you should? It could be a spouse, a friend, a child, anybody in your life. The way of Jesus means a radical and robust commitment to love people regardless of how we feel, regardless of what's happening, just as he does with us. Let me pray. Father, thank you that in Jesus we have the absolute model of commitment. Thank you that we can embrace that, take hold of that, enjoy that. Ask that we would experience the feeling that comes with that of a God that is committed to us. And I pray as well that we would be a people that honour our commitments, that we would take seriously what commitment looks like, whether it's a marriage, a friendship, whatever. Help us be people that live with utter integrity and experience the joy that comes in the long run for committing to people and things properly. Amen.